This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As my guest Karen Armstrong writes, religion can express the wonder and mystery of the human experience. Faith helps people find value and meaning in life. For people of the Christian faith, this is the holiest time of year. My guest Karen Armstrong is the author of the new book, A History of God. It's about the idea and experience of God as expressed in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Armstrong describes how monotheism emerged in a pagan world, and she considers the similarities and differences between the three monotheistic religions. Armstrong is a former nun who now studies the world's different religions. She lives in England. She describes her new book as being a history of the human idea of God.
Throughout history, Jews, Christians, and Muslims have all been very careful to insist that our idea of God, our experience of God, is radically different from the reality to which it points, which is beyond ideas, beyond words, beyond concepts, and beyond human understanding, and it's absolutely mysterious. And so they say they made the point that all our ideas about the divine, about the sacred, can only be human and man-made. And they are, as it were, symbols of this absolute mystery, which has been experienced throughout human history by all kinds of men and women.
Yeah, you suggest that the Bible should begin, "In the beginning, human beings created God."
Well, that's one way of putting it. They created the idea, their particular idea of God. Other people have expressed this sense of transcendence and mystery in other ways. Buddhists, for example, would talk about nirvana rather than God. And they find our Western notion of a personalized God very limiting indeed. I mean, in fact, some would even say that it was blasphemous because it is simply a projection of human fears, human desires, onto an imaginary being, where they say it's far too limiting. But throughout religious history, people have had a very similar experience of mystery and transcendence, which monotheists, Jews, Christians, and Muslims have decided to call God.
What are some of the most remarkable differences between paganism and monotheism as expressed through Judaism, Christianity, and Islam? I mean, what were some of the major ways that they broke with the past?
Well, it was a painful break with the past. I mean, if you read the accounts of the prophets of Israel, people like Isaiah, Amos, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, you feel a great sense that they are peeling themselves away from the mythological conception of the Middle East and developing quite a different kind of spirituality. I mean, it is difficult. They experience this divine force as a terrible shock. Isaiah felt when he had his vision of God in the temple in Jerusalem, he felt that he was close to death. And Jeremiah felt the divine as a sort of a hideous pain that racked his every limb in agony. What the prophets were insisting on was that history and current political events could yield a revelation of God, that you didn't have to create mythological stories, but God was actually present in the events of this world. And that has continued to characterize the other monotheistic religions. Christianity, of course, goes so far as to say that God actually became human and involved himself that way in human history. And in Islam, the whole idea of God manifesting himself in political events and as a political imperative to create a just and equal society has been equally strong. So that would be one of the main things that they were saying. You don't necessarily create elaborate mythological stories about the creation of the world or elaborate temple liturgies that recreate those ancient myths of the past. Instead, contemplate history. Contemplate the events of this world, and you'll find the divine there.
Now, Karen Armstrong, you are a former nun. You now teach at a college for the study of Judaism and the training of rabbis, and you're an honorary member of the Association of Muslim Social Sciences. So you have some affiliation with all three of the faiths that you discuss the history of in your new book. Do you feel close to all three religions?
Yes, I do. And I think this is one of the marvellous religious events of our time, that for the first time in human history, we have an opportunity, unprecedented before, of getting intimately to understand the faith systems and the faith of other people. Before, Buddhists, for example, lived in very exotic, distant parts of the world, and it was really impossible for Western people, because of language difficulties, communication difficulties, to see what they were on about. And we got very, very distorted ideas of other people's religions. But now, because communications have opened up, we realise that in our different parts of the world, we've all been doing such radically similar things that we'll never be able to see either our own or other people's religious systems in quite the same way again. It's a revolution in religious thought that some people find very threatening, and they're retreating into rather fundamentalist denominational ghettos, but which others find enormously exciting, and I'm one of them.
Do you worship in each of the religions?
No, I don't. My religious history has been rather problematic. And I think that I get my spirituality from study. Mm-hmm. Now, my Jewish friends tell me that I'm tremendously Jewish in my spirituality, because, of course, the notion of immersing yourself in a sacred text or in a religious book, and getting, as it were, glimmers of transcendence and mystery from that intensive study is a very Jewish discipline. And similarly, the Benedictine monks have evolved a discipline which they call Lectio Divina, divine study, where they say that you, just like Jews, you throw yourself into the text, open yourself to it, and you will periodically get moments of intense oratio, or prayer, where your mind is sort of lifted up and you sense a mystery. And I suppose that is at the moment, though things could change, my chief means of worship.
You said religion was very problematic for you when you were young. What was the idea of God that you grew up with?
A rather harsh taskmaster. I definitely saw God as a personality up there who was like a human being or an earthly authority figure, very carefully taking notice of my faults and failings, and who would be angry or displeased if I didn't live up to his hopes for me or his desire for me. And that I found very inhibiting. I also found it difficult. I spent, of course, my years in a convent, a great deal of time in meditation and prayer, trying to get in touch with this God. Nothing seemed to happen. Whereas I never seemed quite to have a religious experience that I wasn't aware that at some level I'd manufactured for myself. Now, I wish I'd known then some of the things that I've discovered since, that certain rabbis or Sufis, the mystics of Islam, would have taken me aside and said to me, look, Karen, you can't... You have, in a sense, to create your own way of knowing God. You have to create your own experience, and that God isn't going to talk to you like a person, because he is not a personality that uses words necessarily. In fact, some of them would go so far as to say that God does not even exist, that it's wrong to use words like existence to describe a reality that's on a completely different plane. And that's why Jews, Christians and Muslims throughout the history of monotheism have preferred to call God nothing rather than something. Now, this was light years away from the God of my childhood, who became rather a sort of a dreaded taskmaster to me. But I think it's an idea that of God that many people in the Western world share. And in Britain, certainly, many people have abandoned it. I mean, we're a very secular country here in Britain, and London is said to be one of the secular capitals of the world, because people no longer find this God, either this notion of God, either credible or desirable.
If your image of God was as this stern authority figure just waiting to punish you, why did you join a convent? Why did you want to become a nun?
I was aware that this was a limited view of religion, even to an extent even then. I began to read the writings of T.S. Eliot, St. Augustine, some of the 17th century English metaphysical poets, and began to realise that there was a whole range of sort of mystical and spirituality that I wanted to get in touch with. I wanted to share in that, but it wasn't, the religious life wasn't for me, and I think I don't regret my years in the convent in the slightest. I think it was an extremely valuable and privileged time for me, and I left the religious life with tremendous sadness. Because I felt that I could only regain my own integrity by returning to the world, but it was a very painful decision, probably the most painful decision I've ever made. But I wanted to find this reality called God, but I couldn't find it in that setting.
Why couldn't you find it in the convent?
I think that very few human beings are able satisfactorily to lead an entirely celibate life, to live an intensely communal life, and to own no possessions, and to be entirely pliable to the will of another. I did meet one or two nuns in my religious congregation who were admirable human beings and who were clearly fulfilled by this way of life. But there were others, and I was one of them, for whom it was not right. It's very, very difficult indeed to live a holy celibate life, for example. And I think, too, that at that time, we're talking about the 1960s, before the reforms of the Second Vatican Council had filtered through to the religious orders. Convents and indeed monasteries were in rather a bad state. They'd got fossilised, a lot of old unhealthy traditions had got sort of pickled, and we were being made to conform to Victorian standards, really. We were being turned into young Victorian young women, there's no particular religious significance attached to the Victorian period. This was just a distraction. But there was also a lot that needed sorting out. And later convents did sort out the essentials from the cultural baggage they'd acquired along the way. And indeed, many, many people did leave the religious life. And I think that during the 1970s, and I think that's a healthy development, because, as I say, this kind of life is very hard, and I think only a few people can live it successfully.
In your book, you write that God figured very little into the life that you led in the convent. How could that be?
Well, we spend a lot of time on what I might call secondary religious enthusiasms. There's a great deal of time was spent on Jesus and thinking about the rule, and a great deal, unfortunately, and this was one part of some things that were wrong with religious life at that time in many congregations, on our own failings and on our own performance. Now, if you're concentrating so much on yourself and your own virtue and your own prayer life and your own observance of the religious rule of your order, you're falling into what Buddhists would call an unskillful state, which simply embeds you in the ego rather than helping you to transcend it. We were all so conscious, at least I certainly was so worried about myself and how I was getting on religiously, that if a religious experience had come along and hit me on the nose, I wouldn't have been capable of responding to it, because what the great masters of the spiritual life say is that really take your eyes away from yourself, lay yourself aside, you're not that important, and try and get beyond that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Karen Armstrong. She's the author of the new book, A History of God, The 4,000-Year Quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Let's take a short break, and then we'll continue our conversation. This is Fresh Air. Back with Karen Armstrong, author of the new book, A History of God, The 4,000-Year Quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. What was it like for you when you first started studying Islam and Judaism and, you know, becoming interested in the other monotheistic religions?
I found it amazingly liberating and wonderfully inspiring, and I continue to do so. Also, don't forget Eastern Orthodox Christianity. We often rather chauvinistically forget about Eastern Christianity in the West and assume that Christianity is a Western phenomenon. But of course, Christianity began in the East. All the important theologians in the early church were Greeks speaking and all came from the area that we now know as Turkey. And they have a really quite different notion of God and the divine, which I found in many senses more congenial to me than my own Roman Catholic tradition. And I think that's one of the fascinating and wonderful things about comparative religion. It's not that you want to convert necessarily to another religion, but rather that looking at other religions makes you see your own in a different light. And you see things, I see much more clearly now what my own tradition was trying to do at its best by looking at what Jews, Muslims and Eastern Orthodox Christians were making of the same problems.
Do you still think of yourself as Catholic?
No, I don't. I am no longer a practicing Roman Catholic for all kinds of reasons. I admire the spirituality of the Roman Catholic Church, its sort of spiritual history, its liturgy. I have great problems, however, with the Vatican, with some of its ideas of the idea of the infallibility of the Pope and the obligation to believe certain things, which is a trap into which Western Christianity has fallen. We got into a doctrinal obsession, which is quite alien to the other faiths. Islam and Judaism, for example, are religions of orthopraxy. They have, they insist that you do things in a certain way. But what you believe about God within reason is very much your own business. There's no word for theology in Hebrew as such. But theology has been an absolute obsession with us. And Christians and have divided and split up from one another into denominations on abstruse points of doctrine, which seems to me to be in danger of an idolatry, which not in the sense of worshipping a statue, of course, but in the sense of raising a human image of God and the divine to an unacceptably high level by saying that any human idea can adequately express the reality that we call God. In other words, God and religion are not realities that are objective, like science, the same for everybody, but they're they're deeply, deeply subjective. And I think that sometimes, certainly in the Roman Catholic Church, there's too much stress on believing certain things. We've begun to equate faith with belief, with accepting certain man-made religious opinions.
So when people say to you, what is your religion? What do you say?
I usually say that I'm a freelance monotheist. I draw sustenance from at the time being from all of them, and I think that that's probably quite a valid way to be at the end of the 20th century.
So, what will you be doing on Christmas?
Well, on Christmas Day, I shall probably go to church with my mother. And then I shall come back. We shall probably put carols on the radio. And we shall have a very pleasant and happy day.
So the fact that you no longer think of yourself as Roman Catholic doesn't stop you from enjoying Christmas?
There's certainly not. There's no point in flouncing out of a church in an egotistic way. What one does is see what the Christmas story means. It's an extraordinary example of the pathos of the divine when it encounters the world, something that Jews and Muslims have suggested too. The whole theme of incarnation, as I said earlier, is found in nearly all the world religions, even in Judaism and Islam. So that looking at the Christmas story, the Christmas myth, can be an extremely fruitful religious experience. You don't have to belong to be a paid-up member of a church or a card-carrying Catholic to see the religious significance of a festival like Christmas.
Tell me more about what the Christmas story means to you.
I think that at Christmas, we see God involving himself in the world in a very particularly daring way. I think it is a myth. It was conceived in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke as what Jews call midrash, as a reflection on the life and message of Christ. And I think it shows God involving himself with the world, and that God and humanity are inseparable, that what we like to think of as the divine is not just a reality out there, but it is within and part of the human race too.
You know, a lot of people now are trying to recreate religions to be more relevant to today, to be less sexist, to add rituals that make sense in the context of life in the 1990s. Are you comfortable with that idea of reshaping religion to suit contemporary values?
Look, there's nothing whatever new about this. What my whole book is trying to say is that this change has always gone on. It's nonsense to think that we can believe in God and Jesus in the same way as the first Christians. Our whole worldview has changed. And throughout the histories of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, each generation has had to confront its particular modernity, confront its own times. The problem will come if people are so stuck in their, what they regard as tradition, that they won't let the religions adapt, and then they'll die. Religious people are very pragmatic. When a religious idea ceases to work for them, that they let it go. And the religions and religious ideas of God, have constantly been changing.
I want to quote the final part of the last sentence of your new book, A History of God. You wrote, "If we are to create a vibrant new faith for the 21st century, we should perhaps ponder the history of God for some lessons and warnings." What are some of the lessons and warnings you're thinking of?
Well, I'm thinking in particular of the tendency to personalize God so much that we make him simply give a stamp of divine approval to our own prejudices, our own likes and dislikes, and use religion to marginalize other people, to perpetrate injustice on other people, to even sometimes even persecute other people and kill them, which is what the monotheistic religions have all done at various times in the past, instead of cultivating the humble, compassionate ethos that says that God is an ultimate mystery, and because God is in each one of us, every single one of us is a mystery, too, that must be honored and regarded as sacred.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and a very happy Christmas to you all.
And to you, and a happy New Year, too. Karen Armstrong, she's the author of the new book, A History of God. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Grosson. This is Fresh Air.